Good evening. A Green New Deal is proposed in Congress. Federal officials admit many more thousands of children have been taken from their parents at the border than earlier revealed. And the City Council hears from the victims of police violence. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the WBAI Evening News for Thursday, February 7th, 2019. Trucks carrying U.S. humanitarian aid destined for Venezuela arrived Thursday at the Colombian border. Opposition leaders vowed to bring the supplies into Venezuela despite objections from President Nicolas Maduro. A U.S. official speaking off the record said the United States is pre-positioning relief items, including food, nutritional supplements, hygiene kits, and medical supplies in Colombia. The focus of Venezuela's political fight now hinges on whether Maduro will allow the aid to enter the country. Maduro denies a humanitarian crisis exists and says Venezuela is not a country of beggars. The Venezuelan military has barricaded a bridge between the two nations with a tanker and two cargo trailers in an apparent attempt to block the aid. Meanwhile, Venezuela's communications minister appeared on state TV, claiming Colombian intelligence, the CIA, and an exiled Venezuelan opposition lawmaker were behind a plot to overthrow Maduro. And the Green New Deal, which has so far been a campaign catchphrase about solving climate change and inequality in one fell swoop, just got real. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts are introducing a joint resolution laying out the main elements of a legislative plan. It describes a 10-year economic mobilization that would phase out fossil fuel use and overhaul the nation's infrastructure while building whole new layers into the existing social safety net. Ocasio-Cortez introduced the bill at a news conference in Washington on Thursday, but she said climate justice needs more than just one resolution in Congress.
The solution is not going to come from just one congresswoman from the Bronx. It's not going to come just from one senator. It's going to come from all of our representatives as a country saying this is what Iowa needs. This is what Virginia needs. This is what Michigan needs. This is what Illinois needs. And this is what New York needs. Because all, you know, when we have this threat that challenges all of us, the solution is going to take all of us too.
But Ocasio-Cortez's package is already getting shade from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who referred dismissively to the proposal as the Green Dream, or whatever they call it. Nobody knows what it is, but they're for it, right? Ocasio-Cortez brushed off the comment as she enthusiastically plugged her idea.
This is a big day for activists all over the country and for frontline communities all over the country. Today is a big day for people who have been left behind. Today is a big day for workers in Appalachia. Today is a big day for children that have been breathing dirty air in the South Bronx. Today is a really good day for families who have been enduring the injustices of drinking dirty water or who have seen their living rooms being flooded in with the waves of rising sea levels. And today, I think, is a really big day for our economy, the labor movement, the social justice movement, indigenous peoples, and people all over the United States of America. Because today is the day that we truly embark on a comprehensive agenda of economic, social, and racial justice in the United States of America. That's what this agenda is all about. Because climate change and our environmental challenges are one of the biggest existential threats to our way of life, not just as a nation, but as a world. And in order for us to combat that threat, we must be as ambitious and innovative in our solution as possible. So what we are doing today and in introducing these resolutions here today is that it's not a bill. It is a resolution. And what this resolution is doing is saying this is our first step. Our first step is to define the problem and define the scope of the solution. And so we're here to say that small, incremental policy solutions are not enough. They can be part of a solution, but they are not the solution unto itself. There is no justice and there is no combating climate change without addressing what has happened to indigenous communities. That means that there is no fixing our economy without addressing the racial wealth gap. That means that we are not going to transition to renewable energies without also transitioning frontline communities and coal communities into economic opportunity as well.
While focusing on renewable energy, Ocasio-Cortez said the plan would include existing nuclear power plants but block new nuclear power plants. Asked how the plan would be paid for, Ocasio-Cortez said it would be the same way we paid for the original New Deal, World War II, the bank bailouts, tax cuts for the rich, and decades of war with public money appropriated by Congress. And a high-ranking government official told lawmakers Thursday that neither he nor anyone he knew of at other federal agencies would have endorsed it, would have endorsed separating children from their parents at the border had they known that the Trump administration's zero-tolerance immigration policy would involve separating families. U.S. Public Health Service Commander Jonathan White made the admission during a House Oversight Subcommittee hearing where lawmakers met to discuss the findings revealed in a January report by the Inspector General for the Department of Health and Human Services. The gentleman was questioned by California Representative Raul Ruiz.
Commander White, do you understand the effects of toxic stress on children?
I have a professional training that does indicate that toxic stress, that's an accepted scientific reality, has consequences both for children's behavioral health and their physical health, and those consequences are frequently lifelong.
So this problem is not over even after they unify the child with the family, right?
The consequences of separation for many children will be lifelong.
Yes, in March 2017, the American Academy of Pediatrics published a public policy statement opposing the separation of mothers and children at the border, stating, quote, federal authorities must exercise caution to ensure that the emotional and physical stress children experience as they seek refuge in the United States is not exacerbated by the additional trauma of being separated from their siblings, parents, or other relatives and caregivers. You mentioned a tender age, Commander White, children under 5 or children under 12. In your opinion, were they re-traumatized by our federal government when we separated them from their mothers?
So I've previously testified before the Senate.
Yes or no? Do you feel that they were re-traumatized by being separated from their parents?
Separation of parents is a traumatic event and has the potential for having those psychological consequences.
So let's be clear. Is there a nullification of re-traumatized, or is this an additional trauma that adds additional stress and additional harm to a child after they experience the difficulties that they experienced in their home country going through the long trek? Did we add additional re-traumatization to that child?
For many children, that is a foreseeable consequence, yes.
My understanding is yes.
And that was California Representative Raul Ruiz, and he was questioning a representative of the Department of Health and Human Services on the report that was released earlier today on the true numbers of children who were separated from their families. Dr. Lewis Krause is affiliated with Rush University Medical Center and specializes in psychiatry, child and adolescent psychiatry as well. Speaking last year, Krause highlighted the known effects of separating tender-age children from their parents.
A child losing their parent is the greatest fear that a young child can have. And when that parent is removed from them and them not knowing whether the parent is alive or dead, that's the worst nightmare I could imagine for a child. In the short term, a child can lose their appetite. They can become fearful. They can lose weight. They can become dehydrated. It could be a life and death situation. We're going to have significant mental health concerns with these children, including depression, anxiety, and post-traumatic symptoms. Nobody seems to be concerned about the children and the impact that this is having on them. Nobody seems to be concerned about reuniting the children with their families. The quicker this situation can be resolved, the less likely that there will be long-standing trauma.
The Health and Human Services report found that thousands more immigrant children were separated from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border than the initial 2,737 separations first reported by the government. Thursday's hearing comes more than a year since the zero-tolerance policy was first put into effect. Lawmakers volleyed hours of questions for White and other witnesses about the glaring operational inadequacies discovered across numerous federal offices since the separations first began. And in related news, the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights is concerned that force feeding could constitute ill treatment that goes against the convention, which the United States ratified in 1994. The UN statement echoes concerns raised by 14 Democratic lawmakers who sent a letter to U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement on Thursday requesting more information about 9 Indian men on a hunger strike who have been force-fed through nasal tubes. One of the detainees refusing food, a 22-year-old man, described being dragged from his cell 3 times a day and strapped down on a bed as a group of people poured liquid into tubes pushed through his nose. As many as 30 detainees are said to be involved in a hunger strike at the El Paso detention facility. And you're listening to the news on WBAI, listener-sponsored radio in New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. In local news, the New York City Council is considering a new package of bills to make the NYPD disciplinary process more transparent. The legislation would force the NYPD to give the council more information on internal disciplinary cases. Currently, NYPD officers are protected from revealing past disciplinary actions against them by a local law called Law 50A. Council members and activists say the law has been used to allow brutal cops to get away with mistreating the public, especially people of color. At Thursday's hearings, family members, defense lawyers, and others spoke out on how their loved ones were injured and in some cases killed by cops who should never have been in uniform in the first place. Linda Perry reports.
The New York City Council brought in family members to testify. Families impacted by police violence who are working together to demand justice and to push the de Blasio administration, the New York City Council, and the NYPD to deliver greater police transparency and accountability. New York City Council Speaker Corey Johnson says it's painful to listen to family members and to see the grief, trauma, and loss associated with the loss of their loved ones.
These families deserve justice. They deserve answers. And if there are police officers who are still on the force that acted inappropriately, that were involved in what most individuals would deem as misconduct, where now these families have to live with this for the rest of their lives, we need to do right by them. We need to do right by the citizens of New York City, because the police department does a tremendous amount of good work every day in this city. And I think it's important to acknowledge that. But when there are mistakes, we have to say that, and there have to be consequences.
Johnson wants to right the wrongs and see how the city council can be involved in making sure that if an officer does something wrong, illegal, outside the patrol book, that they suffer the consequences. He questions Assistant NYPD Commissioner Ben Tucker.
Commissioner, do you agree that if you were a family member of someone who was killed, taking 4 years for a departmental trial, how painful that would be?
Oh, listen, of course, I can understand.
So then why has it taken 4 years? Why has it taken so long for Daniel Pantaleo, the officer who killed Eric Garner, to be brought to departmental
trial?
Well,
but I think you know part of that answer, and it's not always been in our court in terms of the process. I mean, there is a process to these prosecutions and to the way discipline is meted out.
But if it takes so long, it feels like something's broken. It feels like the process is broken if it takes this long.
Well, it's taken far too long from our perspective as well.
New York City Council Speaker Corey Johnson with Assistant NYPD Commissioner Ben Tucker. Unarmed 18-year-old Ramarlee Graham was killed by NYPD Officer Richard Haste in his own home in the Bronx in February of 2012 in front of his grandmother and baby brother. Haste was charged with manslaughter, but the charge was dropped. Ramarlee Graham's mom is Constance Malcolm. Here's what she says.
They refused to let my mom testify. She was in the house when everything happened. They made it look like she was never there in that trial. She never told what happened. She didn't get a chance to tell what happened. Only Richard Haste and his little goons with their fabricated stories got to testify. She and my son was the only witness apart from the rest of them that was in the house, the officers that was in the house. She wasn't allowed to testify. So basically, you never heard her side of the story.
Deputy Commissioner Kevin Richardson in the NYPD's Advocate Department handles disciplinary cases against cops.
Richardson also When I met Richardson, I asked him, can you have your team come to my house to see the layout of my house? Because what the officer was saying happened, it couldn't happen that way. I begged him to have his team come to my house. He said yes. He told me yes. That never happened. I also think that if they would have came to my house in this trial, they would understand a lot more about the apartment and what these officers were saying did not happen the way how they said it went down. Because the layout of the house would have shown there's no way these officers could have been in the hallway when they said it happened and how it happened. There are many examples I could go into, but like I said, it's so much. But today, as I sit here, Richardson is not fit to be in that office. He needs to get fired from that office.
Malcolm speaks up for Gwen Carr, Eric Garner's mom. Eric Garner, who died at the hands of police officer Daniel Pantaleo.
As you know, Eric Garner was murdered July 24th by NYPD. It's been 5 years later. Daniel Pantaleo, the officer who choked Eric, and threw him on the ground unlawfully and arrested him. Officer who lied in the official report, and you hear testimony all the time. These officers continue to lie on reports, and nothing has been done to them.
Brooklyn Council Member Inez Barron.
The opportunity to hear directly from those families that are impacted. And I'm glad that you gave them the time to be able to tell this story. But until we have change, and until we get a mayor and a police commissioner who acknowledge that the lives of Black people, brown people, poor people of all colors are important, and that the NYPD certainly does not have any privilege that insulates them from being prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. And until we get citizens who understand that as well, it's going to continue to exist. And until we get people in power who are willing to acknowledge that all lives are important, particularly Black lives, brown lives, and poor people, because they're the ones who have been subjected to this. So until we can get that, we're going to be coming here again and again. And 50A is one of the ways that we can get information about those officers who have a history of engaging this kind of activity. I want to remind you that Kenneth Boss, one of the people who killed Amadou Diallo, had killed before. So we can't forget this. We can't slip it under the rug. We've got to make sure that we get the laws in place and get people to have their minds awakened and sharpened to the fact that crime is crime, even when it's committed by those who wear a blue uniform. And justice has to be served.
The New York City Council is hoping that a new package of bills will reform the broken NYPD disciplinary process. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.
And on Friday, the police commissioner, James P. O'Neill, said he would begin releasing more information about departmental trials and would support legislation to make more of the department's disciplinary records public. And Governor Andrew Cuomo ripped into the MTA Thursday during a Manhattan lunch, vowing to rebuild the beleaguered agency from the ground up in exchange for a controversial congestion pricing plan. Cuomo cast the Metropolitan Transit Authority as a bureaucratic Frankenstein that refuses to innovate, citing the averted L train shutdown as his wake-up call to how the agency operates. Meanwhile, a week after a judge lifted a restraining order, the state began imposing a $2.50 congestion pricing fee for every cab that goes below 96th Street in Manhattan today. The state-mandated surcharges were signed into law by Cuomo last year. The charges were supposed to begin on January 1st, but a coalition of taxi drivers and medallion owners filed a lawsuit saying the extra charges would destroy their industry. Bhairavi Desai is executive director of the Taxi Workers Alliance. She says the purpose of the surcharge is not to rebuild subways, but to aid the app-supported ride industry.
In 2018, last year, the governor basically championed a version of congestion pricing where only taxis and for-hire vehicles would be assessed the tax. And in the final hours, companies like Uber spent $100,000 to get a carve-out for themselves, to get a lower tax amount. So Yellow Cab would be assessing $2.50 per trip. And meanwhile, Uber, Lyft, via any of the app companies, which of course are, you know, have the dominant market share right now, if the passenger requests a group ride, the company doesn't have to match them. As long as the rider requests a group ride, they can be assessed only 75 cents. Meanwhile, you know, neighborhood liveries that are in lower Manhattan, for example, you know, Yellow Cabs, which 90 to 95% of the work is now in the congestion zone of 96th Street and below. And by the way, it's not only if you pick up or drop off in the zone per trip, it's also if you pass through the zone. So if you're going from Brooklyn up to the Bronx, you know, on the FDR, then at the end of that ride, if it's a green cab, you'll be assessed $2.75 tax. It's just, it's devastating. I mean, this is an additional tax on a workforce that is really on the brink of, like, you know, real devastation. I mean, there's a just a deepening poverty among drivers in New York City, and particularly for yellow cab drivers, given it's the majority of their fares, you're talking about a loss of income of like $15,000 a year. You know, for people barely making $30,000 nowadays, it's just, it's unlivable. And it's so unconscionable that Albany championed this version of congestion pricing, you know, with the blessing of these corporate Wall Street giants.
Desai says the solution will eventually have to be hammered out in Albany by the legislators. She says unless action is taken, it might be the end of hailing cabs from the street in New York.
So we're fighting for an exemption for yellow and green cabs. And we ask the members of the public to support us. I mean, this really, this feels like a real, you know, the real existential threat. I mean, this feels like the big, last big stand for the yellow cab industry. You know, even like things have been so difficult for people. There have been so many evictions and foreclosures and bankruptcies. I mean, 8 of our driver brothers took their own life because of the financial despair. There is a real serious crisis in this city. It's an orchestrated poverty in order to benefit these Wall Street companies. And we need the support of the community to help us fight back. Yellow and green cabs.
Well, that's an uphill battle politically with the governor supporting all of this, right?
Uber and Lyft have spent more on lobbyists in the year 2016 than, you know, Walmart, Microsoft, and Amazon combined. So we know what we're up against, but, you know, this is the right fight. Drivers have already contributed $1 billion to public transportation through the years. And, I mean, these are folks right now, they're just fighting to literally put food on the table. This is the profession they've invested into. They've given back to the city of New York with their labor through decades, through generations. There's still about 300,000 street hails a day. Even though the number of trips has really fallen, affecting driver income, we also know that there are many New Yorkers that still rely on street hail service. And that's what's at stake here.
The communications director for the advocacy group Transit Center is Ben Freed. He agrees with Desai that limiting congestion pricing to cabs is unfair.
The fee on cabs alone is really just a partial fix. If we really want to reduce traffic in the most congested part of Manhattan, we need to apply a congestion fee to every private vehicle that operates in Manhattan below 60th Street. The cab fee alone may decrease some mileage in cabs and Ubers, but that's just going to open up space that other vehicles are going to take. So it's not a comprehensive fix for our congestion problem, and it's not fair to the taxi drivers to be paying this fee while other people can drive into Manhattan below 60th Street without paying it.
What is congestion pricing and why does New York need it?
The type of congestion pricing that Governor Cuomo has been talking about is a cordon toll. You basically draw a line around the most congested part of the city and you charge a toll to enter that zone in a car. And what we've seen in other cities that have implemented a congestion charge like this, including London, including Stockholm, is that it has a real and immediate reduction in traffic levels. And that means that buses can move faster. It means our transit gets better. The revenue can get funneled into subway improvements. So it can be a really high impact policy to reduce traffic and improve transit. But just putting the fee on cabs alone is not going to change much.
What would the New York City that your group would like to see look like?
So we want to have fast, reliable transit that works for all New Yorkers. Subways that arrive on time, that operate as fast as they should, buses that you can count on, that can get you to work. We don't want to have a system where 50 people on a bus are slowed down by a few people in SUVs. So when we're talking about congestion pricing, we see a lot of potential to clear up street space so our buses can work the way they should. And when the buses and the trains work the way they should, that's when New York City is really at its best and works the best for all residents.
Ben Fried is Communications Director for the advocacy group Transit Center. And finally, the new Democratic-controlled House is looking at proposals to compel presidents and presidential candidates to make public years of their tax returns. But the burning question is what Democrats might do more immediately to get such files from President Donald Trump. That goal has been high on their list of priorities since they won control of the House in November's midterm elections, but asking for Trump's returns is likely to set off a huge legal battle with his administration. The Democrats tried and failed several times to obtain Trump's returns as the minority party in Congress, their newly energized leftward wing, is pushing the chairman of the powerful House Ways and Means Committee to set the quest in motion and fast. The organization, funded by billionaire investor and Democratic activist Tom Steyer, has run a TV ad in Neil's home district calling on him to, that's the head of the representative who's head of the House Ways and Means Committee, Richard Neal, Democrat of Massachusetts, calling on him to subpoena Trump's tax records as a prelude to starting impeachment proceedings. The issue comes to the fore in a hearing Thursday by the Ways and Means Oversight Committee. And that's some of the news for Thursday, February 7th, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Catherine Davis. For the WBAI EV News, I'm Paul DiRienzo in New York. If you have questions or comments about the day's news, you can always direct them to our email, which is paulnews@wbai.org.